From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Faith Middleton, and this is Fresh Air. I'm sitting in for Terry Gross during her vacation. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with film director Fran Rebel-Kazooey, whose first film, Tokyo Pop, has just been released. The movie's a humorous look at the way Japan has adopted much of American popular culture. Also, I speak with illustrator Ralph Steadman. During the 1960s and 70s, his brutally sarcastic drawings were the perfect complement to gonzo journalist Hunter Thompson. Dr. John returns to the piano with a tribute to James Carroll Booker III, and critic Ken Tucker reviews a new home video documentary about one of the most eclectic folk bands ever, Fairport Convention. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is Fran Rebel-Kazooey, who is currently making her directorial debut with the film Tokyo Pop. It's the story of a young American punk singer who decides to move to Japan because her career in New York is going nowhere. In Tokyo, she finds American pop culture has invaded the city. The landscape is covered with Mickey Mouse and McDonald's, reggae bars, and rock and roll. The American singer Wendy joins a Japanese rock band and starts going out with the band's singer, Hiro. The band only sings cover versions of popular songs from the West.
Well, then how come you sing other people's songs? Why don't you write your own?
I write sometimes. But nobody wants to hear my songs. They're in Japanese and about me.
I want to hear your songs.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
I want to be a real rock and roller. I should sing in English. You know, like Mick Jagger. And John Lennon. And Frank Sinatra.
Who?
Frank Sinatra. You know, My Way.
My Way.
Sinatra?
Yeah.
You want to sing like Frank Sinatra?
Yeah.
Really?
The story of Tokyo Pop bears a resemblance to that of its author. Fran Rebel-Kazooey is married to Japanese filmmaker Kaz Kazooey, and the two divide their time between Tokyo and New York. She wanted to make a film that would show her experience of first encountering Japan and of seeing her own culture filtered through a Japanese lens. Fran Kazooey and her husband Kaz Kazooey run a distribution company for independent films. They've introduced Japanese audiences to American films, such as She's Gotta Have It and Stop Making Sense, and they've brought to the U.S. the Japanese films Comic Magazine and The Crazy Family, among others. I spoke with Fran Rebel-Kazooey from the National Public Radio Bureau in New York. I asked her why she wanted to make Tokyo Pop.
Well, this is my first film, and other filmmaker friends of mine had always said that when you make your first film, it's a good idea to make something about you or something you know about. And being a woman and living in two cultures, I thought nobody had ever really made a film about that. And I'm married to a Japanese man, and I live both in Tokyo and in New York, and I commute back and forth and have for about 6 or 7 years, every 6 or 7 weeks, gone back and forth between Tokyo and New York. And it's a very strange existence. People ask me where I live. I say, on United Airlines. I have my own seat and everything. And I thought, well, no one's ever expressed that in a film. No one's ever used the imagery of constantly being exposed to two different cultures, and no one's ever described being totally foreign in a very strange foreign place, especially as a woman.
Well, the main character in your film, the American woman, is always being told by some of the Japanese men, "You won't understand. It's Japanese. This is Japan. You won't understand." Was that your experience?
Oh, yeah. I could make a loop of that. You know, I mean, while I was making the film, the crew kept on saying to me, "This isn't the way you do it." And I kept on saying, "Well, it's a way of doing it," whatever it was. And they said, no, you don't understand. And I kept on saying, okay. I mean, it's to me, a constant part of living in Japan.
Well, how is your movie different from some of the other American movies that have shown Japan?
Most people who make films about Japan are trying to describe Japan or explain Japan. I think my film is different because I don't want to explain Japan. And I want to explain what I don't understand about Japan and what's inexplicable about Japan. I think Japan's probably one of the great paradoxes of all times. And so I wanted to, if you say camera moving very, the camera's always moving very quickly past things, to linger on selected things that in the 11 years that I've been there have eluded me. Mm-hmm. And fascinated me about contemporary Japan. To my knowledge, no one's ever set a story in contemporary Japan.
How did you find Wendy, the lead character, who's played by Carrie Hamilton?
That's a strange but very true story. I saw her picture in People magazine on a plane between New York and Tokyo. We were in the casting process, and I was reading my People magazine and saw this picture of this blonde, and I ripped it out and I started showing it to people I was working with and said, this is exactly what Wendy looks like. And no one mentioned to me that she was an actress because she wasn't available. She was doing Fame. And since I was traveling so much, I really hadn't seen Fame for two seasons, which is what she did. And we finally got the green light and a start date for the film, and I kept pointing at this picture and saying, this is what the actress should look like, and I'd seen hundreds of girls and never found Wendy. And finally my casting director said, she's an actress, but she's on Fame. And I said, well, it's the end of the season, I'll bet she might be available. And so we called her agent that day and we sent a script to her that day. She got it the next day and read it immediately, called her agent and said, this is me, I've got to do this. So within 3 days, I was on a plane out to Los Angeles. She walked in the room, our eyes met, and there was no doubt in either of our minds that we wanted to work together.
Then you started looking for the male lead hero who plays the musician boyfriend.
Actually, I had found him first. I didn't know I found him. When I was in the final stages of the script, a friend of mine who is a manager in Japan of rock musicians and has a record label there and has been very helpful to me, named Makoto Fukuda, had introduced me to this kid he had just signed who had never made a record. And said, you know, this kid would probably be really good for you as a reference for your script. And I went to a rehearsal studio. He showed me a picture of him and gave me a tape of his music. And he sounded like a really interesting guy. So I went to a rehearsal studio where his band was rehearsing. And I fell instantly in love with this guy. He was just terrific and loose and fun. And really rock and roll. And I started spending time with him and going out to clubs and meeting his friends as reference for the character of Hiro. And it began to dawn on me that he was Hiro and that he could play Hiro. His grandfather was a very famous no actor, and so he came from a family that understood about the theater.
Did he know English?
No, he didn't speak a word of English.
How were you going to solve that problem?
Well, I didn't know. I mean, it was my first film, and I was very naive about a lot of things. And but the one thing I knew is I had met most of the really famous young actors and musicians in Japan in the process of casting, and none of them were what I was looking for. And specifically, the Japanese style of acting is very different from American acting. It's very formal and very external. And if anything, I would say that I was very informal and very internally oriented. And every actor that I met, you know, if you expected happiness, they sort of were happy. And if you expected angry, they acted angry.
In a stylized way.
Yeah, in a very, very stylized way. And some of the bigger stars were so into being stars that I knew they'd never be able to deal with a foreign woman, that it was a totally, totally different concept. They were pampered and spoiled and had their personas, and I knew I'd never get past that to breaking down this style, highly stylized and formal acting that they would do. And so it began to dawn on me that if I built an actor, I'd probably do a lot better. And Yutaka is an extraordinary person and a really interesting artist and probably one of the loosest human beings I've ever met.
So do Japanese directors and artists have the same kinds of relationships that American directors and artists have?
Absolutely not. In Japan, the director is king. Certainly not queen, I'll tell you that. You know, is never even called by their name. They're called director, kantoku. No one even refers to them as their family name or anything. And so, for starters, one of the things I did when I was working with the Japanese crew was I insisted that they all call me Fran and not director, because Japanese society is very formal and very vertical.
Did they have a hard time doing that?
At first, but by the end, nobody had a problem with it.
Well, you've made a couple of references to something. You've said certainly not queen, and there was one other thing that you said about. You know, stories have been written about traditional Japanese men who refuse to take orders from women in American companies.
Met a lot of them. I want to just talk about the relationship between directors and actors, and then I'll get to that. Because in Japan, the director really, really is king. And actors are just vehicles for the directors. And my style is totally, totally opposite. And that is that I'm there to help actors create characters. And I'm really only there to help them make the choices which they need to make in order to give a good performance. And so my way was to create an atmosphere which was very supportive of the actors. This is Carrie's first feature film and Yutaka's first film. And Carrie was 7,000 miles away from home in a culture where she didn't speak the language and didn't understand a lot. And I had to be very supportive of both of them. But in Japan, the director is always just ordering actors what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And the crew was very taken back at my being so supportive and pampering the actors and saying, if they didn't like a take, I'd just say, well, okay, we'll do it again. In Japan, film is so expensive that if the director's happy, that's fine with everybody. And the director also screams a lot at the actors. I mean, if you miss a mark and you have to retake something, the director will scream at the actor, don't you dare make a mistake again. Get it right this time. Well, if I'd done that to my two actors, I would have lost them.
Yeah, and did you have men saying they wouldn't take orders from you?
Yes, yes. One of the actors in the band, the Bebops, quit during rehearsals because he said he had never worked with anybody who was so nice and he didn't know how to be nice, and that he expected me to scream at him and I hadn't screamed yet. But when we started shooting, and it's impossible to direct a movie without screaming. I mean, eventually you have to say, everybody be quiet, or if you have 500 extras, you've got to scream very loudly, action. And, you know, you've got to keep several hundred people moving for 12 hours a day. And the crew was scandalized that I would scream. And my husband produced the film. And they took him aside around the second or third day of shooting. And they said, listen, women are not supposed to scream. And she has got to stop this.
They said this to your husband?
Yeah. And my husband said, I would like to remind you that she's not a woman, she's a director. And have you ever worked with a director who hasn't screamed? And they said, no. And he said, well, there you have it. You've got to accept the fact that she's not a woman, she's just a director. And that was very hard for them at first.
My guest is film director Fran Rebel-Kazooie. Her new film is called Tokyo Pop. It's produced by her husband, Kaz Kazooie, and stars Carrie Hamilton. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Fran Rebel-Kazooie, director and co-writer of a new independent movie set in Japan called Tokyo Pop. Your movie shows crowds of teenagers on the street dancing to Elvis, to Elvis music. Does that go on in Tokyo?
Oh, it really does. Every Sunday, the kids gather in Yoyogi Park, which is in the center of Tokyo, and there'll be thousands of kids, and they'll start gathering around noon when they stop all the traffic in the park. It's like Central Park. And there'll be thousands of kids, and they all bring their, you know, their cassette recorders, and they get dressed in 50s costumes. And there were several different groups. There's the rockabilly kids that dressed in 50s costumes with, you know, crinolines. The girls wear crinolines and ponytails, and the guys have these regent hairdos and wear black leather pants and dance to Elvis. And then there's the Takenoko kids, the bamboo shoot kids, who wear sort of like kabuki costumes and do very, very strange dances that are very formalized. And then there's now the break dancers, who will come in little breakdance uniforms and wear Run DMC sweatshirts and gold chains around their necks and have designer linoleum that they set up. And they have breakdance teams, and, you know, they all stand with attitude, and it's very funny.
In many of your scenes, I can also see McDonald's and Kentucky Fried Chicken, and I'm told there are Mr. Donuts all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
How much of America's fast food places are in Japan, in Tokyo?
Oh, a lot. This is probably my favorite subject. See, I have this theory about the modernization internationalization of the world, because Japanese people don't see that as American fast food. They just see it as food. I've met lots of Japanese kids that consider hamburgers to be Japanese food. They don't really see McDonald's as American.
Oh.
I was speaking to some of the guys in Yutaka's band. The band in the movie is not his band. He's part of a band called the Red Warriors. And I was speaking to them one day, and we were talking. They asked me where I lived, and I kept trying to describe where it was in Shibuya, which is like saying the East Village or something in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And I finally said, well, I live near the Wendy's. And they said, oh, yeah, sure, we know where that is. And we got into a discussion about Wendy's, and I said it was an American hamburger chain. And they said, no, come on, Wendy's is Japanese. I said, no, Wendy's is American. And they really don't perceive it as Japanese, as American fast food. It's the same as we don't really consider cassette recorders and Sony televisions and things like that to be Japanese things. They're made in Japan, but they're American.
In your movie, the characters are eating in them, and, you know, I wondered if on the inside, are they Japanized in some way? Is the food exactly the same?
No. It's sort of altered for the Japanese taste, and everything is smaller, because Japanese people have, you know, usually eat less food. The hamburgers are thinner. The donuts are a little smaller, things like that.
Well, so this is not a case of them wanting to be American.
No, it's just part of modern culture.
And they think it's their culture.
Yeah. It is their culture. You know, I tried very hard in the film not to be condescending and not to show Japanese people doing things that they don't really do. And there's a scene where the where Hiro's sister is trying to learn how to use chopsticks by watching a how to use chopsticks video at home. And I read someplace in a magazine that 60% of kids under 20 don't know how to use chopsticks. And that's really true. And I said to the crew, I want a video that teaches kids how to use chopsticks. And they said, that doesn't exist. And I said, you go into a video store and I'll bet you'll find one. And sure enough, they're sold in every video store. Hmm. Even Japanese people aren't even aware. I mean, people my age aren't aware of things like that. You don't need chopsticks to eat fast food.
My guest is Fran Rebel-Kazooey, director and co-writer of a new independent movie set in Japan called Tokyo Pop. Do you have complicated reactions, though, when you see some of these references to American culture in Japan?
About my movie or just in general?
In general.
No. To me, Japan is a kind of Rorschach test for people. People see in Japan what they want to see. Some people see geisha girls and temples and Zen Buddhism, and other people see technology and great business savvy. And people tend to see what they want to see. So descriptions to me are always really interesting because they say a lot about the person who's talking. I thought Mishima was a really interesting movie. It was a film about the novelist Mishima, made by Paul Schrader. And to me, that film was as much about him as it was about Mr. Mishima. I think Tokyo Pop is as much about me as it is about Japan. And so when I hear people talk about Japan, it's always interesting to me.
In your movie, I noticed that the TVs are on almost all the time in people's homes, no matter what's going on. Is that true?
Yeah. There's televisions every place. There are even televisions in the taxi cabs. You get in a taxi cab, and mounted between the back seat and the front seat is a taxi cab on the ceiling. And you put in 100 yen, and you can watch the sumo wrestling fights or...
What kinds of shows are
on? Soap operas. Soap operas in the afternoons, samurai dramas at night.
Game shows?
Game shows, yeah.
And how about their commercials? Are there commercials like ours?
No. There's very little hard sell on television commercials. They're more like public service announcements here, sort of soft and much more indirect, which is very much like Japanese culture.
I'm always mystified when cultures are exchanging information. And what happens when each other's translations go back and forth? We know a man who has a Japanese pencil box, and it says on it in English, "Be a man, temporary, contemporary." Do you see examples of that kind of thing back and forth?
Yeah. Well, Japanese people love to use English words, just English words. In the scene, there's a very quick scene of some kids dancing in the park, and one of the girls is wearing a jacket that says Bronx Boils. What does that mean? I have a great sweatshirt that says Fatty Potamus. Japanese people love to it's the sounds of things.
Yeah, I was going to say, where does all this come from? Who's doing the translating, I wonder?
Elvis is part of rock and roll history to Japanese kids. He's the same as Mozart. That's where rock and roll comes from. He's a classic. Mm-hmm. And that's very faithfully translated.
Yeah. I think. A lot of your romantic scenes in Tokyo Pop take place in these love hotels, in these sort of glitzy Liberace-style beds. Is that true, Tokyo?
Yeah, another favorite subject of mine. Japanese people live in very small apartments, usually with paper or paper-thin walls, sliding shoji screens between the rooms and everything. And they don't have a great sense of privacy. That's not part of Japanese life. Everybody lives in, you know, usually the grandparents will live with the family and the, you know, and children. And so there'd be three generations living under one roof. And it's very hard for couples to be alone. And so these love hotels were built for people who want privacy. And they're called love hotels. They're called leisure hotels. They're called fashion hotels. I've even seen them called reading rooms, where they say you can come to read magazines. If that's what you want to call it, that's fine. But they're really just places to be alone.
Yeah. So do you see movies like yours, or your movie specifically, as one to increase understanding between the two countries, or are you trying to stay away from all that?
Oh, no, that's exactly what I want. I wanted to make a film that would work both for American kids and Japanese kids, and American adults and Japanese adults. I don't think you're ever going to create understanding between the two cultures with one movie. If this just touches 10 people on both sides, that would be fine with me.
You're traveling back and forth, I know.
Yeah.
Do you see America differently now?
Well, one of the things that inspired the film was when my husband came to live here, he started meeting Japanese Americans. And I would look at them and I'd think of them as Japanese people. I wouldn't think of them as being as American as me. And that kind of shocked me with inside myself, because I'm only second generation American, and I'd meet Japanese people who were third or fourth generation American and much more American than me. And during the war, their parents had been put in concentration camps here. And I started thinking, wow, I'm less American than a lot of these people. And so I started thinking about myself as an American and what kind of American I was. And I realized I wasn't a very deeply rooted American. And I wanted, you know, that I live on the surface in America. And so, yes, after making the film, I'm even more aware of that.
Do you feel like you have a true home?
No. I feel like I live wherever I am at the moment.
Thanks for coming in.
Sure.
My guest has been Fran Rebel-Kazooie, director and co-writer of a new independent movie set in Japan called Tokyo Pop. I'm Faith Middleton, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, Terry Gross will be back. Her guest will be reporter Nicholas von Hoffman. His new book, Citizen Kone, is about Roy Kone. I hope you can join us.
What it's want for the money? Time for the show. Ready now, go, can't go, but don't you step on my blue suede shoes. What you could do with a thing, my love, my blue suede shoes. You can knock me down, step in my face, slander my name up over the place. Do anything that you wanna do. Oh, honey, honey, lay off my shoes, don't you step on my blue suede shoes. What you could do with a thing. Drink my sake at the karaoke bar. Do anything that you wanna do. Oh, honey, honey, lay off my shoes. Don't you step on my blue suede shoes.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks, featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Faith Middleton, and this is Fresh Air. I'm here while Terry Gross is on vacation. Coming up, illustrator Ralph Steadman recalls the shocking day when he, a naive Englishman, was exposed to the full extent of American tackiness. Also, Dr. John joins us at the piano for a tribute to the man he calls the Black Liberace, James Carroll Booker III. And critic Ken Tucker reviews a new home video documentary about Fairport Convention, the eclectic folk band that never enjoyed the commercial success the critics predicted. That's all ahead on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Mara Liasson. President Reagan today moved to increase the pressure on the military regime of Panamanian General Manuel Noriega. The president has imposed new sanctions under the International Emergency Economic Powers Act. NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports from Santa Barbara.
The executive order imposes two main sanctions. It freezes the assets of the Panamanian government in the United States, and it prohibits any payments from the U.S. government or U.S. companies or subsidiaries to the Noriega regime. The freezing of assets, mostly money in banks, will make it far more difficult for Panamanian banks to operate normally, something General Noriega needs to be able to do. The free flow of funds will be stopped, the financial system strangulated. As for the loss of payments to the Noriega government, the amount could be very substantial. These kinds of economic sanctions have been imposed before, against Iran and against Libya. If the United States wants to impose additional sanctions, including trade sanctions, it would require an additional executive order. In today's executive order, President Reagan declared that Noriega's policies and actions constitute an unusual and extraordinary threat to the United States. In Santa Barbara, this is Wendy Kaufman.
Banks were supposed to resume normal operations today in Panama. At least that is what the government there had predicted. But the banks are still closed, as they have been now for more than a month. NPR's Tom Jelton reports.
Last week, the government's banking commission announced an agreement had been reached with private banks on the restrictions under which banking operations would resume. Government officials said today is their target date for the bank's reopening. But they made no further progress in their negotiations. Private bankers were concerned there was insufficient cash in the system to permit anything approaching normal operations. And they said the government's national bank was still incapable of clearing checks for its member banks. This week, government officials threatened to order banks to reopen today. But on Wednesday, directors of the government-owned savings bank sent a letter to the acting Panamanian president, Manuel Solis Palma, advising him not to push for a reopening of the banking system. "We unanimously believe," the bank directors wrote, "that neither the savings bank nor the banking system as a whole should open their doors to the public as long as this crisis continues." So the banks did not open today, and no government action was taken against them. In Panama City, I'm Tom Jelton.
Cypriot officials have agreed to provide more fuel for a hijacked Kuwaiti airliner with about 50 hostages on board. The plane landed today at Larnaca Airport in Cyprus. It took off earlier today from Mashhad Airport in Iran after 3 days on the tarmac there. Its arrival in Cyprus followed a tense standoff at Beirut Airport. More from Jim Muir in Nicosia.
The hijacked airliner spent 3 hours circling over Beirut Airport, and there were tense scenes as the hijackers insisted on trying to land, while the airport authorities, backed up by Syrian troops, were adamant in refusing permission. Several times the plane approached the runway at low altitude, with the pilot telling the control tower that he had a gun at his head and would crash land if necessary. At one stage, Syrian troops who'd blocked the runways fired warning shots at the airliner. The Syrians apparently won the battle of wills. The hijackers gave up and headed west towards Cyprus, where the authorities relented and gave permission to land at Larnaca Airport. The pilot, clearly relieved after his ordeal, radioed his thanks to the control tower, saying he'd never forget it. Cypriot authorities declared a state of emergency at the airport, and the foreign minister arrived to handle negotiations. For National Public Radio, I'm Jim Muir in Nicosia, Cyprus.
The Nicaraguan peace talks continued for a fourth day today in the southern Nicaraguan town of Sipawa. Representatives for the government and the rebels appear to be at odds over U.S. aid to the Contras. Stock prices today rose to their highest level since the October crash. The Dow Jones average closed the day at 2090.19. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Mac Rebenek, also known as Dr. John, joins us at the piano again this week for another tribute to one of his favorite New Orleans musicians.
Right now I'm going to play a little bit of music by a guy considered the greatest New Orleans piano player, most versatile of them all, and a guy who's the only one I ever considered that I knew that was a genius. James Carroll Booker III played a style of piano that they call, I believe they call it butterflying or a little stride, and it's a style of piano where you play your left hand like so. So just a motion thing that a lot of piano players have used. But more to the thing, I'm going to play some of the music that he was known for, a thing he did on a Pine Top Boogie that we recorded in the 50s and a few other times, and this is it. Pine Tops Boogie a la James Booker. And I like to do an old 8-bar blues that he had recorded in the 50s with a group called the Hawks. And it's a song called Ayaya, which is a New Orleans way of saying, I hear you. You make the hair rise on your head. You can call up old man Henry. You can ring up Mr. Ross. They gonna tell you, they sure gonna tell you how much your funeral will cost. Ay, 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 ay. That's Eight Ball Blues a la James Booker. One of the things that he always had going that none of the rest of the cats did, he had a great classical training. He had gone through college as a teenager and went to work as a very young child as a studio pianist and on the road with artists such as Joe Tex and Marvin Gaye and Fats Domino, innumerable artists of various different kinds. And he taught me how to play organ and taught many of the guys so much of the music. Very responsible for the Neville Brothers being what they are today. And it's a privilege to be able to do something of his.
Mac Rebenack will be back next week with a tribute to Cousin Joe. This is Fresh Air. Behind the eyes of British satirist and illustrator Ralph Steadman, you'll find a curiously gentle man who's horrified and repelled by American culture. Steadman is best known in this country for his savage drawings that accompanied gonzo journalist Hunter S. Thompson's books and articles in the late 60s and 70s. With Thompson, Steadman went to the Kentucky Derby, yacht races at Newport, Rhode Island, the 1972 Democratic Convention in Miami Beach, and Washington, D.C. for a summer of Watergate hearings. Fortunately, Steadman doesn't come to the U.S. very often. He's illustrated a new book entitled Scar-Strangled Banger, based on his travels here during the 70s and 80s. He's included some biting commentary and observations, and I asked Ralph Steadman how his travels through America with Hunter Thompson changed him forever.
It was that which I think deranged me. I was such a naive, you see, an innocent abroad. And I responded to the screaming lifestyle by just, lashing out with drawings of... I used blood clots, actually. I didn't use ink at the time. I just sort of dipped it into anything that looked red and made myself as obnoxious as I could in retaliation.
Well, as I wheel through your book, Scar Spangled Banger, I realize, you know, that you see America in the form of all-night liquor stores, Saturday night specials, those huge Gestapo-like policemen, White House characters playing in a pen filled with excrement. People would think that you hate America from looking at those pictures.
No, I probably enjoy drawing those sort of people. I mean, drawing nice people is no fun, you know. There's nothing to get your teeth into. No. That's why there's no good people saying, well, they're rather savage and unpleasant, or they're rather this or that, which are not a compliment. Well, what's the point of being like that if, in fact, the idea of satire is to genuinely pinpoint something, or if you use a better phrase, nail it, you know?
I know you had that list of odd jobs that so many artists
yes.
have, and you went in the service. What was the thing that really made your work take off?
I think probably it was finding that seam in me which was alerted by Hunter S. Thompson. I think that's what started it. I think he suddenly realized something, that he had met somebody like myself who was looking at something as though for the first time, and that he'd forgotten how it looked. because he got used to it.
You and, let's say, daredevil writer Hunter Thompson, who first introduced you to America, you traveled around together, and there are all those stories about, you know, the two of you in this sort of alcohol and drug-induced state,
yes.
you know, cruising around America and that kind of thing.
Yes.
Did you get in trouble with your relatives when those stories came out?
My relatives? I don't think they really understood what I was doing. I just think they felt it was part of my work. Take my mother, for instance. She's in her 80s now, and she felt that it was just... She didn't quite connect. She couldn't. I mean, she'd never been abroad in her life, and she couldn't connect with such a thing that I might be doing. And I don't think she ever thought for a moment that my taking drugs was anything more than taking an aspirin. And I didn't take them that often. I mean, it was just something that I guess I got curious about, but I found that it was completely unsuited to my nature, which is already in a mess, you know. I mean, got some kind of a garbage can down there, which only takes a Valium to upset. So I don't really use drugs very often, or if at all now.
What did your own kids think at the time?
Fascinated by it, actually. But do you think that I was a bad example as a father? Because I've got five children, and there I was, careering around the place, being totally irresponsible.
Well, let me ask you this. Did they get conservative in reaction to you?
Yes, except one of them did begin sniffing glue. I don't really have that phenomenon over here. I think it's gone out of it over there in England. And I wrote to Hunter about it, saying, you know about these chemical substances. What do I do about my son? And he said to me, how do you, Ralph, expect to go around the world drawing denatured pictures? Or look, Maggie Thatcher and Ronald Reagan looked like denatured pigs. And you expect your son not to want to sniff glue? Nobody is privy to that kind of logic. It doesn't seem to make sense. So you can expect some kind of help, but I'll tell you what, he said. Send the little bugger over to me with a certified check for $10,000 and I'll straighten the little bugger out. Kids are like television sets. They need a whack on the head from time to time.
Did you do it?
No, but in fact, I showed him the letter. He did actually stop. It's extraordinary. Hunter could be a very good child psychologist, you know, or advisor on psychological problems. You know, he gave Theo something to laugh at, as my son. But it did help. Well, he stopped taking it, so I guess it works. You know, people get too pious, perhaps, about what one should do and what one shouldn't do, particularly when counselling the young.
Have you ever been afraid of someone's reaction to your work?
You mean like a punch in the mouth or something? Perhaps that. I don't like physical violence, but that's why I get rid of it in my drawings.
Have you ever been sued?
Once, for a drawing I did of a man called Charles Forte. Trust House Fortes are quite a well-known chain of hotels around Europe, anyway. I don't know whether he has them in America. But I once did a collage. I didn't draw a single line. I did a collage of his face made up of actual photographs of chicken's breasts and legs and sausages and Neapolitan ice creams, making up his face with coffee cup for one eye, and his moustache was made of sausages, and his hair was sausages, and he had a chicken leg for a nose, and the top of his forehead was a chicken's breast. And it looks so like him. And he's all about food, but bad food. You know, he does bad food on motorways, you know, freeways, you call them. And it seems to me that that really upset him in such a way. Well, he did sue me. It was sued out of court. I mean, we settled out of court because it was done for the Sunday Times in London.
Have your victims, shall we say, ever requested the original drawing from you?
It happened once or twice, but I've preferred not to give them. You know, it makes them so much... They think you give them to them. That's what I usually find is the case. They feel that I'm going to be so flattered to be asked by some people that to give them the cartoon that I should just give it to them. But I'd rather either charge them an enormous amount which they couldn't pay or keep the drawing.
You know, I'm always intrigued with what America chooses for art on her postage stamps. And I read that you did a stamp once. What was it like?
Well, it was rather romantic. I did Halley's Comet, you know, that went over last year.
Uh-huh.
And I did a set of four pictures of the comet in various places in relation to the Earth as it was coming towards it. And I did one other one, which they refused to use, and it was a picture of the Ethiopians on the earth, and the Halley's Comet going over, beautiful, in its, all its beauty and everything about it, so looking gorgeous, and yet and being completely indifferent to what was happening on the earth. It was just passing by. And I think I called it Earthly Bodies, Heavenly Bodies. And you, that was, you, it was refused because they felt it was rather too political, and they didn't want to say anything like that on a stamp.
Well, do generations raised on TV understand the power of cartoons and illustrations?
Do they or will they? I think they become rather blasé about them, or rather immune to their power, because, as I say, they're treated in newspapers as a very sort of poor relation to the rest of the newspaper, rest of the content. There's something to fill a space, and kids treat them that way. But they are potent images when they're at their best. I mean, when I think of things like Goya, people like Goya and Hogarth and George Grosz during the Weimar Republic days in Germany, they were doing images which were unrelenting in their commitment. And that's what I think is missing now. And the papers tend to want just safe images which just fill a space. And, of course, they're not going to be impressed, young people being brought up on television today. They get too many powerful images on television. They're not going to bother with a cartoon unless it hits them between the eyes.
But you're going to keep going.
Yes, but I must tell you that as I get older, and I am getting older now, I'm getting more philosophic, and I'm doing a book at the moment on God. But it's a thunderbolt, a sort of a non-partisan thunderbolt from above. And it's something I have to do now to be non-partisan, not to look at it. I realize now that it isn't about good and bad in our, you know, that are good people and bad people and bad will change. I do think that we're all pretty lousy.
Ralph Steadman's new book, Scar Strangled Banger, is published by Salem House. You're listening to Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Let's check in now with co-host Robert Siegel to find out what's going on. What are you working on, Robert?
Hi, Faith. Well, we're working on the hijack story, of course, the jet that went today from Iran to Larnaca in Cyprus. Also, following diplomacy over Afghanistan, a report on what the deal is by correspondent Ted Clark, reaction from Moscow reported by Ann Cooper, and what the effect of the Soviet presence has been on Afghanistan. We hear from Richard Barnett, the co-author of a lengthy and very interesting report in the New Yorker magazine this week. Also, as the Democratic primary campaigns have made it to New York State, we have a report from Mike Schuster on Mario Cuomo, the most popular of the non-candidates.
Sounds good. Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Critic Ken Tucker has a review of a new home video documentary about one of the most unusual folk music groups spawned in the 60s, Fairport Convention.
Measure, Fairport Convention is one of the most unusual groups in popular music, and this is the main assertion of the documentary It All Comes Round Again. This English band, founded in 1968 and enduring with different musicians right to today, has never fit in with any trend, any style, any particular way of thinking about pop music. It All Comes Round Again was produced and directed by Paul Covett specifically for the video cassette market. It isn't like any other rock film. It doesn't capture a band at the height of its stardom, because this band never became a star act. Talk about a hard day's night. Fairport Convention, led by guitarists Richard Thompson and Simon Nicol, did a heroic job of combining Celtic folk music and electric rock in a way that summoned up ancient history while sounding utterly contemporary. But try getting that sort of thing on the radio. Here are band members Dave Swarbrick and Ashley Hutchings giving a few of the wistful details themselves.
Went from hippies, you know, who really didn't care about money, who would go out and do a gig for a washing machine. I mean, that actually happened. To people who had a a strange concern for money, but it was more a concern for the amount of the debt that was building up. It still baffles me now why someone like Island Records, or Chris Blackwell in particular, should allow the group to continue with an £80,000 debt when £80,000 was £80,000.
I would say that a musical form could have easily become as big as, say, American Country and Western. It could have been an English equivalent. As it is, it's very small.
The story is not totally downbeat. Richard Thompson established himself as a terrific solo recording artist, and a reformed version of Fairport still performs an annual tour to a small but fervent cult following. One member of the band observes that the group makes more money as a reunion act than it did in its original form. Like Fairport's music, It All Comes Round Again isn't afraid to be old-fashioned. Scenes of Fairport in performance alternate with interviews with the musicians filmed at various times in their careers. What comes across most clearly is the idea that this was a group with grand ambitions, few of them realized, and blessed with a great lead singer, Sandy Denny. She died at the age of 31 of a cerebral hemorrhage when she fell down a flight of stairs. This film includes the only known footage of Sandy Denny performing with Fairport Convention. The band has made a lot of records, and at least three great ones: What We Did on Our Holidays in England, Unhalf Bricking, and another called Liege and Leaf. The best of this music can be heard on a compilation album called The Fairport Chronicles. But to really get a feel for what it was like to be in a band that knew it was great, but had no idea how to communicate that idea to a mass audience, you have to see It All Comes Round Again.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. It's been great fun being here these past couple of weeks. On the next show, Terry Gross is back, and we'll speak with writer Mary Morris about her travels through South America. Her new book is as much about her decision to travel alone as it is about the rural towns of Mexico, Honduras, and Guatemala. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead will review a reissue of the post-war recordings of Woody Herman and the Thundering Herd, one of the best-known big bands. And television critic David Bean Cooley will review The Street, a new cop show that strives to pick up where Hill Street Blues left off. I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
It's a great staff. Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Thad Kirk. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Our theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. I'm Faith Middleton. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.